Golazo. So we return now for the last time in this cycle to the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, or also very helpfully called taking the mind as the path. The mind as the path, as you now well know, this is very familiar territory from the surface level, the most obvious level of your conscious mind. The activities of the mind, taking that is kind of like all aboard. There's your vehicle. Taking that vehicle and watching the vehicle itself dissolve until it's finally dissolved when you come to the terminus, the end of the line. Of course, now you know so well. That's the substrate consciousness. And then once you're there, then if we go back to this text that I've referred to a number of times, the Sharp Vajra Tantra, then the next vehicle, now it's almost like you've taken the local train to the major station, and now that train has come to the end of the line, and now you get into another train, another vehicle, or another path, and now you're taking dharmata, or ultimate reality, as the path. So it's chunyi lamdu kirwa, taking ultimate reality as your path. Now you're meditating on emptiness until you gain realization of emptiness. And then the next stage beyond that is now just, and they don't even say taking pristine awareness as the path, because pristine awareness is the ground, the path, and the fruition simultaneously. So it's not linear. You're not taking it from here to there, because it already was, it is, and it will be simultaneously in fourth time. So you can't take something in the fourth time and have it be a path or a vehicle from here to there, because it's both here and there and in between. Right? But there's something, I find this just enormously appealing, perhaps on an aesthetic sense or because of my scientific background. And as much as I love Buddhism, and I even love Tibetan Buddhism, and I love Tibetan culture, there's a part of me that says, culture comes and goes, just like my life comes and goes. It's not that big a deal. A culture may come and go and take a few thousand years. A person comes and goes. It takes a few decades. But this is now going really, has nothing to do with culture. Taking your mind as a path, that's not cultural. You could be on any planet, and you could take your mind as a path. Taking dhammata, or ultimate reality as a path, well, there's nothing cultural about that either, let alone Rigpa. So there we are, taking the mind as the path. Or again, Dujum Lingpa also called it Nang Rik Lam Du Kerwa, taking awareness and appearances as the path. Awareness and appearances. So some of you have found there's something of a merging of the awareness of awareness with the settling the mind, and that is when you really get into the settling the mind, or it could, as it has in at least one case amongst you, even starting out in mindfulness of breathing, and then suddenly having there being an expansion and being aware quite clearly of the space of the mind, within that space having a very clear and distinct awareness of the events arising within that space, but within that space a subspace of also being aware, noting at least peripherally, sensations of the breath coming and going. But there can be definitely kind of an integration of the awareness of awareness, the doll inside the doll inside the doll, with taking the mind as the path. And perhaps Dujun Lingpa is referring to this when he speaks of taking Nang Rik Lam Du Kyewa, awareness. We're not talking pristine awareness, ultimate awareness. You're just the awareness you already have. Your awareness and appearances. But now specifically, of course, this is appearances in the space of the mind. And it's not open presence. That has its place. But it's taking those, your awareness and the appearances arising in the space of the mind, the appearance of the space of the mind itself, and that's your path. Okay? So AKA, also known as settling the mind as a natural state, taking the mind as the path. So now within this very familiar practice by now, and I think many of you will have already discovered degrees of stickiness in terms of what you're attending to, right? And so, in my experience, it could be different for you, in terms of the events arising in the space of the mind, the least sticky, the least that tend to grab, draw in, invite cognitive fusion, are just images, slides, just images, an image here, an image there, or they may be strung together in something of video. So it's like, consider how engaging it is, how emotionally gripping it is to watching the slideshow of some of your friends who are showing slides they took on their vacation. Here's me at the Eiffel Tower. Here's me at the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Here's me at the Tower of London. It's pretty easy not to get caught up in the drama. So you're just seeing a slide as a slide. You know, there it is. Without distraction, with some difficulty. And without any grasping whatsoever. Yep, that sure is the Eiffel Tower. You nailed that one. You got it right in the middle of the photo and everything. Good homage. And so that's the easiest thing, not to be sucked into. And even if it's kind of just a little stray video clip, again, like home movies of their vacation with no soundtrack, it's quite easy, actually, relatively speaking, quite easy just to see the single images coming up, a string of images coming up, and just seeing the images as images without being sucked into them and having, like almost with whiplash, having your attention jerked over to the referent, what those images are of. So there you see an image of the Eiffel Tower and suddenly, oh yes, Paris, how I love Paris, oh, I wish you were in Paris. It could happen, but it's easy not for that not to happen. Just, it's an image of the Eiffel Tower. Okay, I don't have to think about Paris or the Eiffel Tower, who built it, World Trade Fair and all of that kind of business. It's an image. So that's the easiest one. So if it's a video, it's kind of like a silent film. But then, of course, in the evolution of film, then eventually, what was the 1920s or so, then they brought in the talkies. They brought in soundtrack. And when you have the soundtrack, or let's say radio, I think that was earlier, so just hearing just the audio track, that tends to suck in more. That is because the words always have a referent. If it's a word, I mean, therefore it has a referent. That's why we call it a word and not simply a noise, right? So as soon as I say peach, even just one word, peach, it tends to draw the mind in a little bit more than just looking at the word peach, but then peaches, ooh. So the attention tends to be sucked in, and we tend to be focusing on a peach, or peaches I have known, you know? So a little bit more seductive, a little bit more, have a bit more of a pulling power, the kind of the radio, the chit-chat, the commentary that flows in, all the more so if we're getting a talkie, that is a film, video track with an audio track combined, that tends to be more drawing in. Then it's easy to get caught up in the narrative, and then you're attending to the reference, whatever the movie is about, right? So it's more of a suck, more of a draw, more of a cognitive fusion. And that's all in terms of what is appearing to you objectively, the video, or the visual, and then the audio-visual. So all of those appearing objectively. We can attend to them, I guarantee. I mean, and I think a number of you now know this for your own experience. It is definitely possible to attend to them without simply thinking them. That is, with your attention going off to the referent. Some people have never meditated think that's not possible because they've never had the experience themselves, and therefore they extrapolate. Since I can't do it, nobody can do it. So I've heard, you know, and I've mentioned this before, but some philosophers, maybe it's a minority, Don would know better than I, but I know I've heard it, I know at least two philosophers, world class, that say it's not possible to observe thoughts. Just not possible. Okay, well, I think neither one of them meditated, or at least not meditated effectively, of this sort anyway. And so there we have it, but then we go probe a little bit more deeply. And this relates to the comment, the observations and the question that Quinn raised yesterday. And that is, what about then the more subjective impulses? Quinn spoke of dull anxiety. I think we've all experienced that. Dull anxiety or sense of agitation, antsiness, right? Or restlessness. These kind of states. Or it could be fear. Or it could be anger. It could be resentment. It could be slipping over into the desire mode of craving, of really wanting something. When will the chime sound? I want out of here. I'm trapped on my meditation cushion. Please let me go. You know, and so desire is going to arise. So these subjective impulses, whether they're emotions or desires, those tend to be the top candidates. When they come in, they, in my experience, and then now you have a good database. You can see whether your experience corresponds with mine. If it doesn't, that's perfectly good. If it does, well, that's interesting. But then we, in my experience, these subjective impulses, especially emotions and desires, these tend to be very sticky. So as, again, Paul Ekman, we tend to get caught in the grip of emotions. We tend to get caught in the grip of desires. The stronger it is, the bigger the grip. So what we're doing here in this very cloistered environment, this very calm and peaceful environment, with friendly people here in this room, friendly people in the staff, a very sweet situation, in this kind of situation, then we're in kind of quite a safe environment, and so that we're not being really assaulted by other people, the environment, and so forth on the whole. If we're being assaulted, then we know it's genuine unhappiness and not the hedonic unhappiness. It's coming from within rather than having it being catalyzed or aggravated by meeting with really difficult people. I think, you know, we've had almost none of that in this whole retreat. And so, when this happens, and here we are in this nice, clean, safe kind of contemplative laboratory or mind center, then we can develop this ability, this familiarity, kind of a momentum of having nothing else to do when some surge of an emotion, surge of a desire, surge of a mental affliction, which may be in the mode of desire, they may also be in the mode of emotion. Anger is an emotion. Resentment is an emotion. Craving, greed, attachment, that's in the mode of desire, right? And then there's a wide variety of other mental afflictions. But here we are in this safe environment, very protected, very calm, and having very little to do. Then here, right now, and we have now one more full week of silence. And then tomorrow, next week, then we'll be definitely landing. And that'll be a time for talking and so forth, really a time for transition. But we still have a whole week. Some of you, you know, maybe that's the longest retreat you've ever been on before you came here. So we have one more week of silence. During this time, then, we still have a good opportunity to develop this skill set, and I tell you, it's worth its weight in diamonds to develop this ability to be aware especially of these emotions and desires arising and to be aware of them before you're acting on them. Be aware of them before you're acting on them, before the cognitive fusion. And that is, and it comes right back again to the conversation with Quinn, and it's come up in multiple conversations here, of maintaining a larger spaciousness of your awareness. And of course, this is a bit of a metaphor, but still, it's a good metaphor. A larger space of your awareness than the space of the emotion or desire. In other words, it hasn't totally snared you, encompassed you, swallowed you, such that you are now engulfed in the belly of like a big fish, and you're totally caught in the refractory period of, but I want this, I want this, I crave this, I need this. So a person who's totally caught up in lust or sexual infatuation. I mean, I just can't be happy without you. I can't live without you. I can't live without you. And the obvious retort to that is, well, try. Let's see. That's not what I wanted to hear. All right, but that implies a total refractory period, that if I'm with you, I will be happy, and if I'm not, I'll be unhappy. And that's the story of my life, right? It does sound kind of silly, doesn't it? But it comes up in so many love songs. Why don't people just start laughing when they hear that? I'm not quite sure. But there we are. A larger space of awareness. So it's still, if anger arises, a very strong craving arises, anxiety or fear arise, there's no question where we are in our practice. Is it getting to us? Is it hooking us a bit? Or are we just kind of totally nonchalant and aloof and totally involved as if we're looking at it from the moon down on the earth? No, pretty much we're going to be somehow entangled in it. But then we see there's gradations of that. There's total being engulfed by it, totally caught up in it, in the grip of it. In which case, your attention is totally focused on what you're feeling emotional about. Your attention is totally focused on what you desire. And that's it. I want that. I am terrified of that. I'm so angry at that. I am so angry at that. Total fusion. I am Mr. Anger. I have no identity outside of anger. For the time being, I am just 100% angry. Anger, you know, because the fusion is I am. And there it is. And what are you angry about? That. And so there it is, a cognitive fusion, refractory period. And when we're there, when we're in any of these refractory periods, acting out of perhaps unrealistic fear, out of craving, the mental affliction of craving, out of hostility, resentment, and so forth, when we're totally caught up, and now this is just at any time, when we're totally caught up, there's something in common with these emotions and desires. Emotion already suggests it. Emotion, motion out, motion outwards. And that is when we're feeling a strong emotion, number one, unlike a lot of other mental processes, it shows up on the face. Right? Desire is not necessarily. So right now, okay, I'm desiring something. I'd really like it. And I bet you can't tell what it is. Mangosteen, did it show? Only Brian knows me very well. It was mangosteen. I really like mangosteen. But desire, you might, but you probably, I mean, you just, oh, I love it. It'd probably be even difficult to know desire as such, let alone what I'm desiring. That would be clairvoyant, right? But so desires are not emotions, but when it comes to emotions, oh, get a world expert like Paul Ekman, and he's trained many other people by now. Emotions really show up. They really show up. They express, they press out. They press out through the muscles of your face. And so then, and I don't need to give all the grimaces, but seven classic ones that are true for all ethnic groups, all nationalities. Seven that Paul Ekman identified years ago. He's become quite famous for this, among other things. But it doesn't matter whether you're from Papua New Guinea, where he's done a lot of research, or from New York City, or from Newfoundland, whatever. So they express, they press out, and we can see there's an expression of anger, of surprise, of fear, of disgust, of contempt, of happiness, and so forth. So the point here then, but where you can see the enormous pragmatic value of even now having another week to develop this skill, is that when, especially now, these stickier ones, desires and emotions, just put it that way, desires and emotions, when they come up, you're aware of them as they come up before a refractory period locks in. And then, as I was just about to say, the emotions and desires, they tend to want to get us into action. Emotions, we tend to want to do something. I'm fearful, therefore I go into contraction, therefore I run, therefore I attack. But emotions tend to set us into motion outwards to do something, and of course desires. Most desires are out for something in the world. And so before we launch in some vehicle of emotion or desire, to be aware, and this is a cultivated skill and it doesn't come naturally. Some people may have it from past lives, but otherwise it's not something that just people naturally have in spades, you know, in strength. And that is, as emotions and desires come up, to be aware of them quickly and be aware of them in a way that's not totally sucked up into the desire or emotion. So if anger rises, you get an irritating email or somebody, whatever it may be, and you see irritation or anger arising, very quickly noting, aha, in reading this email or encountering this person or seeing this situation, anger's arising, and very quickly you're recognizing, I see anger has arisen. And it's not being judgmental, oh, what a terrible person am I, or anger is a terrible thing. We don't need to go there. The first thing is simply to recognize, ah, anger has arisen in my mind. And there's a movement there to say something, to respond, to think, to plan, to react. And just being aware of that in a larger space than the anger. So if the anger is 1 foot across, your space is 3 feet across. Larger space. So you're not sucked into it. You're not by the gravitational pull, so to speak, of that emotion or desire. There's a larger space. You see, aha, anger has arisen in my mind stream. And these thoughts, these ideas, these intentions, these desires to act on this anger are coming up. And then just relaxed, resting in a pool of awareness that is wiser than that little nugget of anger. Saying, I see the impetus is there. Probably better not to act right now. Overall, if it's an afflictive desire, an afflictive emotion, it's very possible that something does need to be done. You need to respond, you need to engage with, deal with the situation. But Shantideva's great words of wisdom here is, even if the situation does require some response, best not when your mind is dominated by mental affliction. How can we develop that ability? Through settling the mind in its natural state. Seeing the thoughts that are coming up, seeing the impulses, the desires, the emotions, seeing them. And so then it's all as if there are two minds, but it's not really two minds, it's awareness and mind. It's an awareness, a quiet awareness. Aha, I see anger has arisen. I see a dull anxiety has arisen. I see my mind has become dull. I see very clearly that my mind is dull. And I kid you not, that really is possible. You might have experienced it already. But I'm vividly aware of the fact that my mind is dull. And there it is. And therefore, I don't have to be dull inside it. But seeing, since it's dull, probably now is not a good time to take on different difficult challenges or tasks. So having that larger space, which we're explicitly cultivating in this practice, then this from a modern psychological perspective, as in Paul Ekman, from the Buddhist perspective, then when we venture out into the world, we are developing that ability to be aware quickly of whatever these subjective impulses are, so that we have the possibility, and I know I've said this again, and if we're saying again and again, we have the possibility of making a wise choice. The wise choice may be, maybe not just yet. Or maybe I do need to respond right now, because some situations do require an immediate response. Even if we don't want to, the situation requires that. But then if there's this larger awareness, say, I see my mind is very self-centered here, or my mind is contemptuous, my mind is disdainful. But I recognize that, but my response is not going to be a disdainful response, because that's not helpful. I'm going to respond this way. I'm going to go a detour. Since I need to respond right now, this person has just said something, is waiting response. I can't say, get back to me in 5 minutes when my mind is calm. You know, that would be an interesting way to have a dialogue. But I'm going to kind of like if you were in a car, I'm going to do a detour. If I came right through the traffic, then I'd respond in some kind of a way that would be snotty, disdainful, sarcastic, condescending, or whatever. And I don't want to do that. That's not helpful. And so I know that if I go through the traffic, that's going to be the slime that gets glommed onto my speech. And I don't want that. I'm going to do a detour. I'm going to use my awareness here, detour. I'm going to say something calmer, not denigrating, and so forth and so on, because that's a better choice. And this big lump of contempt, disdain, irritability, what have you, this will dissolve sooner or later. But right now, I'm not going to let that infect my response. Here's my response. And this will be a non-regrettable response. Oh, what a relief. So that's some of the import, the significance, the practical application of this simple practice. It is ever so simple, of taking the mind as the path. But it can be such a tremendous boon and help us avoid so much unnecessary suffering, let alone the suffering we inflict on others when we act out of these refractory periods, where we're totally caught, like seized, like a fish in the talons of an eagle. It may be wiggle a little bit. It's got no freedom. Wherever that eagle's going, that's where the fish is going. It can wiggle all it likes, but boy, when those talons are in it, that fish is in the grip, right? So enormous benefit there. So those are the stickiest ones. Maintain a larger, and you'll still feel the emotion and so forth, but you won't be caught up in it, a larger awareness. And the larger your awareness is, then the more naturally and frankly quickly you'll find that emotion, that desire, in this larger space, then unravels itself, especially if your attention is not fixated on, again, caught in the grip of, the referent of that emotion or desire. You're just aware, this is arising, and you just watch it. And then, this is passing. We're definitely slipping over into that realm of vipassana, the close application of mindfulness to the mind. Now, to end on a more uplifting note, this is very important, but it's not uplifting so much, except for there is a possibility of freedom from entering into a lot of regrettable episodes. But of course, it's not only mental afflictions and negative emotions, difficult, destructive emotions that arise. All kinds of emotions arise. One could be bliss. Bliss arises on occasion. Okay. Now, normally when bliss arises, that's something we actually want to cognitively fuse on. The person who has a sexual infatuation, you know, just totally fixating, obsessing on images of the object of desire, it feels good. It feels good, like, well, this makes me happy. And he or she could make me a lot happier. So there we are, fixated on that image, or our mental images, visual images, or maybe a recording. Oh, the voice. Pitter-patter goes my heart. You can tell I'm not much of romantic. I think I just too old now or something. I'm just not getting into the spirit of it anymore. But we kind of like the cognitive fusion of it, right? It's enjoyable. It has some promise. I'm feeling good now, and you can make me feel a lot better. And you know how. That's why it feels good, right? It feels good, and in eager anticipation, it could feel a lot better. It's grasping, cognitive fusion, identification with. So consider the possibility here. If we're really intent on the cultivation of genuine happiness and not just providing the stimuli for more and more hedonic pleasure, that when pleasure, happiness, joy, bliss arises, to experience that, again, not to try to block it or repress it, but to experience that also in a larger space, and you're simply aware, bliss is arising. Not with the intention or the wish that it will dissolve, but just spaciously experiencing without being totally blissed out or focusing in on and kind of fixating on the bliss or the referent of the bliss, but just allowing the bliss to arise and having that awareness that does not need to be articulated, because you know bliss without naming it, but just experiencing the bliss arising like a rainbow or like a beautiful cloud formation arising in the space of the mind and just being aware of it. But as you're being aware of it in that very spacious way, without grasping, without reification, seeing the bliss is arising, but it's empty. It has no substance, it has no inherent nature. There's nothing really, there's no substance to it. It's an experience, but it's empty, like any other appearance. It's an empty appearance, but this is a subjective appearance. It's an empty bliss. And that phrase right there, de tong, it's called in Tibetan, de tong, bliss emptiness. Oh, that's really a big hot item, especially in Vajrayana, right? Bliss arises, and as you're experiencing the bliss, realize the emptiness of the bliss. Now, that's a path to liberation. Not simply identifying with it, glomming onto it, and so forth. Bliss arises, simultaneous experience, the emptiness of that bliss. You can find this actually in the Pali Canon, in the Buddhist discourse on Anapanasati, of mindfulness of breathing, of not identifying with the bliss or the sense of well-being, but just simply being aware of how it arises as a natural phenomenon, but without the I and mind. We move into the perfection of wisdom. Not only is it not I or mind, but it doesn't even have any inherent nature of its own. It's just an empty appearance arising, one more appearance, this one being a more subjective appearance, but empty nonetheless. And so, de tong zunchuk, the union of bliss and emptiness, that's powerful stuff. That's very liberating. Now, in the course of your settling the mind, you may also on occasion, some of you have, experience just an unprecedented degree or an exceptional degree of clarity, of vividness, of luminosity, of brightness. And once again, it's very tempting because it's nice, it's pleasant, it's appealing to identify with it, to get, to fuse with it, to grasp onto it. But when you experience that, if you can also let that, it's a subjective experience, a quality of consciousness, if you can let that luminosity arise and once again maintain a larger space, that this is a nyam, this is meditative experience arising in the space of the mind, but let your space be larger. So in that luminosity, that brightness, the acuity, the brilliance, the sharpness, vividness of your awareness, when that arises, also seeing that too has no inherent nature, not truly existent, does not exist from its own side. And then we have sel tong zongju, the union of luminosity and emptiness, clarity and emptiness. One more big theme in Vajrayana, really big. The clarity of your own awareness, the luminosity of your own awareness, and emptiness. So now you're definitely getting into the area of realizing the emptiness of your own mind, the emptiness of consciousness itself. Oh, that's big. Now you're moving into definitely the deep end of the pool, right? Now those two terms, the union of bliss and emptiness, the union of luminosity and emptiness, those are really prevalent terms in Vajrayana, in Dzogchen, in Mahamudra. We're now talking about something way beyond shamatha. We're now going really deeply into the path of liberation, of taking reality itself as the path, and actually venturing, breaking through to Rigpa itself, which is luminous and empty. Right? So then when you consider along this little simple path, this local train from the starting point, you're sitting down meditation, you're aware of your own mind, and the terminus, the end of the line of this local train that goes to substrate land, the village of the substrate consciousness, on this little local train, just little old shamatha. In the course of this, as you can develop, as we're really coming towards the end of the retreat, as you now, today and over the coming weeks and months, if you can develop the ability not only of not falling into the refractory period of mental afflictions and so on, but even when bliss or luminosity arises, or for that matter, non-conceptuality, which is then serenity, stillness, peace, tranquility, when that arises, and also not grasping onto that, latching onto it, being attached to it, fixating on it, but realizing that sheer vacuity, that sheer silence, that too is empty. Then along this little local train, from your mind to the substrate consciousness, if you're becoming more and more familiar with maintaining the spaciousness of awareness and seeing the emptiness of bliss that arises, the emptiness of luminosity that arises, the emptiness of non-conceptuality that arises, without latching onto, grasping onto any of them, then as you prepare yourself in that way, along this little local train of shamatha, then sooner or later, when you achieve shamatha, and you simply come to rest in this relative ground state of the substrate consciousness, and then you're being flooded by, simultaneously, with bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality, if you've already gotten into the habit, you become familiar with experiencing them, but not grasping onto, clinging, fixating, identifying with, because you've been doing it along the path, then when you get there, then you are all the more poised for realizing the emptiness of your own awareness, releasing all grasping onto bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality, and realizing the emptiness of your own awareness, that it too has no intrinsic identity, no inherent existence of its own. Then you're poised to just slip right into the deep end, right into Rigpa. Okay? Emaho. Quite amazing. Quite amazing. This simple practice. And then we could, you know, after all that talking, we say, but the practice is so simple. And it really is, isn't it? I didn't say easy, but it really is simple. So let's just practice. I've mentioned it before, but I think it's worth repeating, that what we're seeking to emulate in this practice of taking the mind as a path is viewing the space of the mind and whatever arises within it from the perspective of the substrate consciousness. Now, one may say, but I haven't experienced the substrate consciousness. I haven't achieved shamatha yet. Yeah, fair enough. But that's why I say we're seeking to emulate it, right? You can imagine, you can try to imagine, what it might be like to be resting there in the substrate consciousness, which is now non-conceptual, which means it's not talking. It's not knowing by way of words, concepts, conceptual frameworks. It's a very immediate knowing. That is, the substrate consciousness is knowing. If you slip into the substrate, okay, then you've gone into not knowing. But if you're resting there in the luminosity of the substrate consciousness, then you're resting in the very, it's called the essential nature of consciousness, which is knowing and luminous. Luminous and cognizant. So you are knowing. But it's the kind of knowing that you have even if you never learned a language. It's the kind of immediate or unmediated knowing that you have even if you've never learned how to think discursively. Like, and we experience something like this all the time. How much do you have to think about sweet before you recognize sweet as sweet? And do you know, can you taste sweet? Can you recognize sweet without having a label for it? Sure. How about loud? Like a sound, loud. Do you need to think about it to recognize, oh, loud sound? Clearly not. And so these are immediate perceptual ways of knowing, and that's what the substrate consciousness is. It's not involved in inference. It's not knowing by way of thinking. It's not knowing by way of verbalizing, commenting, and so forth. It's immediate. It's discerning. But it's primal. Not ultimately, but relatively. And so it's that quality of awareness that we're, so when I say in the conversation with Anna yesterday, you're simply observing the nature of whatever's arising. Just there it is, and just getting it, boom, immediate, without analysis, without inference, without saying, oh, that reminds me of, or associating it with this, that, or the other thing, boom, got it. And you just stay right there in that immediacy of knowing, the arrow hit the target, boom, got it. Keep it that simple. And then the next moment is another, ever fresh, knowing, arising with respect to whatever's arising in the space of the mind, or when there's no arising, the space of the mind itself. And as you emulate that, so as with the path, so the result, you're emulating, taking almost again like the fruition as the path, you're seeking to emulate that way of knowing you'll have at the end of the journey, and seeking to emulate that along the journey, and that's what moves you along the journey. Right? So, very useful. Now, when you're resting in that, the more you're cleaning off, like scraping away the scales, the scum, the accretions, the cloud, obscure, configure, this simple knowing of the substrate consciousness, when you just scale it back, skin it off until all the dead skin of concepts, language, and so forth is skinned back, and there you are, just naked, resting in the substrate consciousness, in that mode of knowing, clear and immediate knowing, then you're right at the portal. You're not, that is, you don't immediately have clairvoyance or extrasensory perception, but if you recall that statement by Atisha, he said, there it is, if you want to develop extrasensory perceptions, then shamatha is the ticket. That is the immediate access to opening the door, and then you can, from that, emerge into or develop or extend out into clairaudience, clairvoyance, and so forth, different modes of extrasensory perception. Bearing in mind that if we look at the term just by itself, extrasensory, the knowing by way of the substrate consciousness is already extrasensory, in the sense that it's certainly not by way of the five senses. It is the sixth sense. But it's now cleaned off. It's beyond the, if we liken it to launching the Hubble telescope 300 miles or so above the Earth's surface, so now it's beyond the atmospheric distortions of our planet with all the light and so forth and so on, and haze and clouds and so forth. So now it has a pretty unmediated, there's so little between the Hubble telescope and the distant stars, galaxies, and planets and so forth. So there's so little in between. It's just pretty much empty space and a very, very diffuse scattering of atoms. So here you are, you've lofted. You can either go down or up in whatever metaphor you like, but you've lofted your awareness beyond the atmospheric distortions of your personal history, your language, your acculturation, your mental afflictions, and so forth, your coarse ones anyway. And there you are, poised to extend that out into these modes of extrasensory perception. It'd be quite interesting. So that's what we're seeking to emulate here. It's clear, it's succinct, it's fresh, it's right in the moment, it's unmediated, doesn't talk, doesn't react, but it's certainly getting it, fresh, 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 moment by moment. Now yesterday or very recently, I was talking about the superficial reductionism of Dzogchen meditation to just kind of sitting there being aware of whatever comes up. So I don't need to go there again. But now I want to balance that very helpful conversation I had with Guru this afternoon. And that is, well, okay, I gave a pretty tough line there. I mean, it wasn't my line. I was just reading Dujum Lingpa. So I say, well, I'm pretty innocent there. I was reading his words showing these four modes of open presence. And they're pretty awesome because you're just starting out. Of course, you realize emptiness, and of course you've realized Rigpa, and then it extends into these four modes of open presence. So it's clearly, to be a bona fide Dzogchen practitioner, fully qualified, well, that's a very, very high level, and not to be conflated with just simply being, choiceless awareness, just open awareness. Having said that, though, then I want to balance out again, because when you could very easily interpret my words, and I think it would be unfortunate if you did, and I would be to blame, think, I understand now. Dzogchen is way beyond my capacity. I shouldn't even think about doing Dzogchen meditation. I should stay down here at the shamatha, the four measurables, maybe the four applications of mindfulness, lojong. But who am I to think about practicing Dzogchen meditation when I've not achieved shamatha, don't have any direct realization of emptiness, and I haven't realized rigpa? Then I'm just being pretentious or presumptuous to think I should even start. That too is an exaggeration. Too much. Too much. Because we can just keep on agreeing, but then you shouldn't meditate on emptiness, then you shouldn't meditate on the four applications of mindfulness, you haven't achieved shamatha, and then are you really ready for settling the mind? It's pretty subtle. And then we all wind up just practicing infirmary all day. Right. So avoiding extremes. So now, what I was specifically refuting, and I've got the whole Dzogchen tradition behind me. This is not just my opinion. And that is the notion, I'm practicing Dzogchen, but I don't need that view business, all that theoretical stuff. And the way of life, I want to keep it as is. I just want to do Dzogchen meditation. Well, that's just sheer fiction. I mean, there's just no basis for that at all. It's not Dzogchen. Call it whatever you like. But it is not Dzogchen meditation. And this is not just my opinion. My opinion doesn't matter again. But there is no such thing as Dzogchen meditation without Dzogchen view. And the two of those must be nested within a way of life that is really saturated by the view and graced or anointed or spiced, seasoned with Dzogchen meditation, right? So those three, as I said this morning, a materialistic way of life, a way of viewing reality, materialistic priorities and practices, materialistic practices, and a materialistic or consumer-driven way of life, they're all nested with each other. They're totally entangled. So put those three together, and they're really a driving force to sucking the earth dry. And that's why I said it's killing us. Because the whole force of human imagination, intelligence, is all focused on the hedonic. But with 7 billion people, the planet isn't big enough. The resources aren't large enough. And so this is why we will, damage ourselves if our whole sole vision of the good life is all about acquisition and consumption. That's not a moralistic conclusion or a religious conclusion. I think it's just realistic. With 7 billion of us, we can't afford that. And unfortunately, the rest of the world, I'm speaking as an American, Brazil, India, China, and so forth, are in some ways trying to emulate, perhaps, your choice, but the standards set by the United States and Western Europe, especially right after the Second World War. And I think it's still the case. The last I checked, the population of the United States is about 5% of the population of the globe, and Americans consume about 30% of the natural resources of the planet. Now, shall we all emulate America? Well, for a very short time, and then we just suddenly find we have no fish in the ocean, and all the resources are depleted, and now we have really not Andreas's sweet contemplative anarchy. That could be useful. Now we've got major meltdown, right? Because there's not enough. So, coming back to Dzogchen meditation, as that is a very toxic triangle or triad, materialism, hedonism, consumerism, etc., which will be self-destructive for our race and unfortunately for many other species. Here we move into something quite sublime, a Dzogchen view. Well, so how could we, even where we are now, without having achieved shamatha, vipassana, and all of that, Could we, you know, if some of you know of some very fine lama who's giving a Dzogchen empowerment, is willing to give Dzogchen teachings, would it be presumptuous, premature, what have you, for you to go receive such teaching? I don't say so. No. But then how can we make it authentic? And I think this is necessary. I know I'm running on a little bit, but because I spoke quite strongly about the other side, reductionism, no view, nothing, just flat, just be here now, that's not Dzogchen, okay? How could we envision Dzogchen meditation without already being a highly realized yogi? How could we envision starting to plant the seeds to move in that direction, even like today, okay? If not in this retreat, well, maybe right from this retreat to another retreat. And so, first of all, and I'm speaking to the whole tradition now. What I'm saying is not just opinion, right? I think for the whole Dzogchen tradition. And that is, if you'd like to venture into a Dzogchen practice, be introduced to the Dzogchen view. That must include introduction into the teachings and emptiness. There is no Dzogchen view without teachings and emptiness. So be introduced to those. And I finished almost the final polishing of a translation of a text, Dujom Lingba's commentary to Buddhahood Without Meditation. I've translated it fresh. And there's no, as I recall, as I said before, no references to Shama at all, but lots of references to emptiness, and of course to the Dzogchen view. So it's all there. And it's just kind of assuming, Shama, get that in another text. We're busy. This is the Dzogchen view. But there it is. It's all about the Dzogchen view. And so be introduced to it. Receive the teachings. Develop the understanding of having listened carefully, understood the teachings. So if you were going to take an exam, you could get the right answers, right? Like in a university, Dzogchen 101. You listen to all the lectures, you think about it, you study well, and then you can write down the right answers, okay? That's the understanding that comes from hearing, from studying. It's conceptual, but it's certainly worth something. And then once you understand, okay, this is the Dzogchen view, that the Rigpa is not the same as the substrate consciousness, Rigpa is not the same as emptiness, and then you see, okay, here's the terminology, here's how it relates. I'm kind of getting it, I'm understanding it. Good. Then you go to reflection. Then you reflect upon it deeply with whatever intelligence, creativity, imagination, intuition you have to really try to probe into it, understand it as deeply as you can, pondering it, reflecting upon it, relating it to other teachings you've heard and outside knowledge. For myself, I relate it to quantum cosmology and Christian mysticism, Nicholas of Cusa. I say, oh, resonance. I find that useful. So reflect upon it until there comes some clarity, something more than I just know the right answers in the book that I can get an A on the exam, but it's kind of sinking in more deeply. I think I'm really getting this. I'm really seeing, I think I'm intuiting. This is actually true. This is the nature of Rigpa. Of course it's conceptual. This is the nature of emptiness. I think I'm getting, and not only that I'm understanding it, I'm thinking this is really true. Even though I'm not fully realized by any stretch of the imagination, but some real understanding is arising. This really makes sense. All these appearances, objective, subjective, they're all empty of inherent nature. All objects arise by the power of conceptual designation that congeals them into objects with their attributes and so forth. Rigpa is that which underlies the ultimate fountain, the source, the ground of all these appearances, which are nothing other than displays of Rigpa. All of them, without exception, all of samsara, all of nirvana equally. And that's the nature of emptiness. I'm kind of getting it. And all phenomena being empty of inherent nature, all these appearances, if we ask whence do they arise, they're displays of Rigpa. I'm kind of getting it. Now that you're getting it, just hold that awareness now open, utterly relaxed, loose, without accepting or rejecting anything, without adding or subtracting, without selecting this or that, without grasping onto anything. Utterly at rest, utterly still. And let your awareness be wide open. Doing nothing whatsoever. Being aware. Without distraction, without grasping. And then you can practice open awareness today. And then when you get off the cushion, You don't just bring down the chopping block. You don't bring down the axe. Okay, meditation finished. And when you're moving, when you're talking, you let that, like a fragrance filling a room, that taste, whatever that view was, that sense, that intuition, that way of viewing reality, you let that start to sift into, like a, again, like a fragrance filling the room of your experience, of your world, that as you engage with the world, interact with other people, you haven't left that scent behind. It continues to permeate the experience of everything you're doing, even as you're in motion. But as you're in motion, you may still have that sense of a total stillness while the appearances are coming and going. The total stillness of awareness. So, then that's Dzogchen meditation. Embedded in a Dzogchen way of life, sustaining a Dzogchen view, and you can start anytime. As soon as you receive some authentic instruction. Maybe you will one day. Oh yeah. So, this will look fairly short. Could I distinguish between the subconscious and the collective unconscious as articulated by Jung? Sure. The subconscious. Oh, it didn't say substrate consciousness. Oh. Well, certainly I'm not an expert here. I've studied Freud. I've studied some Jung. But I'm not even remotely an expert in either one. So the subconscious, then it all depends on whose version. Is it Freud's version? Freud, as far as I know, did not have any notion of a collective unconscious. He had very elaborate notions about the subconscious, but it's individuated. Whereas Jung's notion, collective unconscious, the realm of archetypes and so forth. So that would be, I would really suggest, you could probably even get this on Wikipedia or any good encyclopedia or good journal articles comparing these views from Freud and Jung. So I shouldn't really say any more, except for my understanding, what I've just said. Now, if the question, so I'll just leave it at that. I think this would be pretty easy to access, but I would just go to any good online dictionary or even short articles comparing Jung, just Jung and Freud on the subconscious and collective unconscious. But then the next one, the substrate consciousness. Now, if the question were, and it looks like this might be implied, what's the relationship between substrate consciousness and the collective unconsciousness of Jung? Substrate consciousness, now clearly a Buddhist concept, and you know a good deal about it by now. They're not the same, that's for sure. Because as you well know, you've been listening now for 7 weeks, the substrate consciousness is individual, it's not collective. It's your own domain, and it is also accumulating, in a manner of speaking, your memories, karmic imprints, tendencies, and so forth and so from past lives. And so it's not collective. But now if one looks in the Buddhist worldview, which is so vast and multidimensional, is there anything in this whole Buddhist framework that would suggest some strong parallels with the Jungian notion of a collective unconscious? I've written about this at some length in a book called Hidden Dimensions on Physics and Consciousness, and actually writes at some length about the theory of Wolfgang Pauli, a Nobel laureate in physics, brilliant physicist in quantum physics, and Carl Jung. They had an elaborate, years-long correspondence, quite fascinating, in German, but it's been translated into English. So I won't elaborate on that, so hopefully we'll have some time for just open question here, question and answer. But that their notion, which then was united from drawing from cutting-edge quantum mechanics, and it's still cutting-edge. There's nothing old about Wolfgang Pauli's ideas here. And Carl Jung, and he's still so contemporary, and he's really a brilliant man. But their notion of an unus mundus, a unitary dimension of reality that is populated by archetypes, it's an archetypal realm, and it's more primitive than the bifurcation of mind and matter. Mind and matter. That in fact the archetypes of mind and the archetypes of matter are to be found in this unus mundus, this unified reality, and then they manifest like effulgences or displays or holographic images, projections, from this unus mundus, and they manifest as what we identified as, oh, this is subjective mind, immaterial. Oh, this is a bottle of water, that's material. But these are coming from archetypal forms in this unus mundus. And so I explore this in some detail, this unus mundus, whether this might be analogous to, or have a lot of overlap with, the Buddhist notion of form realm. the form realm or rupa dhatu. And my conclusion is it looked like there's a good deal of overlap, especially if you go to the Pali Canon and the Theravada commentaries, where more so than I've seen in the Sanskrit and Tibetan literature, when they speak of this form realm, they do speak of it as being populated by these counterpart signs, or they look an awful lot like archetypes to me, conceptual quintessences, distilled essence of earth, water, fire, air, and colors and so forth. And so it looked like there could be something common there, and it is certainly true, now in Buddhism, that the form realm is not, you don't have your own. You don't have your own individual form realm. That is a dimension of reality that is collective, and you can access it by way of your substrate consciousness, by achieving shamatha and so forth, but it is collective. So I think there might be some meaningful dialogue. It would be interesting for a person who has really studied Jung in detail and really, really studied, I've not done in depth, this Carl Jung Wolfgang Pauli correspondence, and then really launch in and just study everything there is about the form realm in Buddhism, and then, you know, do a doctoral dissertation. So I gave something of a pre-doctoral dissertation that is suggestive but absolutely not conclusive. So that's it. And the formless realm, of course, is beyond that. So the formless realm is precisely that. It does not have archetypes. It does not have forms in it. And so, since I can conclude pretty quickly here, I'll just now venture briefly into a realm of pure speculation. It's informed speculation, but it could be still dead wrong. And that is, if we go back to the Pythagorean tradition, there's some debate about whether this goes back to Pythagoras himself, but back to the Pythagorean tradition, which definitely picks up with the Platonic notion of pure ideas. Okay, so that realm, so that current, and it goes right through the Neoplatonic tradition into Christianity, but the notion that a deeper dimension of reality is one of pure ideas, right? And one version of that is a deeper dimension of reality is pure math. And so if there's some truth to that, and I don't know whether there is or not, but my intuition suggests there is, then this form realm might be analogous to, I'm trying to choose my words carefully here and not pretend to know things that I don't, but the form realm may be analogous to a realm, a subtle realm of just pure geometry, of forms, out of which emerge or are projected all that we experience here in this physical world. And if Wolfgang Pauli and Carl Jung are right, also the archetypes of our subjective mental states also emerging from this form realm. But the notion of it being pure form, and after all it does say form realm, suggests, well, could that have some connection with a dimension of reality that's just pure form, just pure mathematical form or geometry of subtler and subtler levels. And so there, and then the formless realm, and now this is sheer speculation, the formless realm could be beyond geometry to sheer quantity, to sheer number. You know, so like algebra, something like that. Just pure math, but with no forms whatsoever. So it's speculation. But it would be interesting to explore it. There's a man that I never met, I missed him only by months, is Franklin Merrill Wolfe. Very, very fascinating man. Very deep yogi. I do believe he actually did have realization of Rigpa. An American. And he died in 1985, at the age of 98, I think it was. Remarkable man. But he was trained in Western philosophy. He was also a mathematician, and he was also a very ardent practitioner of Vedanta. And as soon as he later learned about Dzogchen, he just said, this is home. And bodhicitta, the bodhisattva ideal, he just said, this is it. This is it. Bodhicitta, bodhisattva ideal, and Dzogchen. And then that was his view for the rest of his life. But it wasn't just intellectual. But he was very deeply interested in, and I think had very deep insight into, the possible relevance of very, very subtle, high-level mathematics with these more mystical or contemplative states of consciousness. And since he was trained at Harvard and Stanford, very well-educated, very smart, but also really a profoundly realized yogi. Quite extraordinary. He wrote 2 or 3 books. So, good. That's that. Any questions, since we're now, this is our last, session specifically devoted to taking the mind as a path. Questions about that practice? Yep. Okay, Brian, you're on.
There seems to be kind of a reciprocal relationship going on between my practice time, which is largely taken up with this particular practice, and when I go to sleep. Mm-hmm. So the way I'm seeing it is that as rumination is declining in this particular retreat,
sure.
After I have gone to bed and done, I usually do either of the three practices as a preliminary for sleeping. Mm-hmm. After that is done, and that's fairly calm, it's as if all the rumination that didn't get a chance to manifest as it normally would jumps me.
Yeah, now that you turn off the lights, the cockroaches come out from underneath the refrigerator.
Exactly. And it's building up, and it's a difficulty just in that it takes forever to get to sleep. It's a tremendous amount of mental energy. Mm-hmm. And this didn't happen. Generally, I sleep very well, so... since I've already tried to apply the remedies beforehand of, you know, the three practices in bed, and, you know, and then suddenly, boom, it comes. I was just curious if there might be a suggestion.
Sure. There was a giveaway in your narration, which implies the suggestion. And that is, over these 7 weeks, rumination has subsided. I'm going to take a wild guess here that you're happy about that.
I'm not grasping that much.
I didn't say that much. I said a little bit.
Certainly I'm not unhappy.
Yeah. The thing is that in the settling the mind in its natural state, when we're doing it perfectly, I mean, just, okay, what's the ideal? Not that we should beat ourselves up when we're not achieving it, but what's the ideal? What's it go like when you're just perfecting it, practicing it flawlessly? There's no preference at all for rumination subsiding at all. There's no preference for the volume, the amplitude, or the nature of them, whether it's just malicious, horrendous, disgusting, appalling, or whether it's just images of your lama, you know, or the Buddhas, or Buddha, you know, Buddha field. It's just no preference. So as long as that preference is quietly there, when all is said and done, I won't tell anybody, but it'll be really nice when the movie theater pipes down. You know? That's suppression. It's suppressing. It is a preference. It's a subtle mode of grasping. And so there you are, and it's like this, you know, the benevolent but stern parent watching the children. Not the old grandfather who he'd care less. Because the mothers are there. Whatever they do, the mother... No, this is the stern parent watching his own children. You are being good, aren't you? I love you, but look at my face. You're not going to mess around, are you? That little bit of pressure. When you're on the cushion, it will subside. It will. Some of your thoughts will turn into bashful maidens, and they will subside. And then, finally, when that pressure is off, and you say, I've done all the practices, I'm ready, then yay, and they all come out. Food fight, you know? So there it is. So it just, it's not, and there's no, I'm not in any way implying you've been practicing incorrectly. This is the nature of the practice, that we practice incorrectly less and less and less until you achieve shamatha, and then you're not practicing at all, and therefore you're not practicing incorrectly at all. So, how's that for the cup half full all the way through to the end? So, a really light touch, and to come back and say the slogans, more like the grandpa, more like the old man, watching the children play with simply no preference whatsoever. Now, there you are. I know a lot of people are sleeping less. I very happily am sleeping less, because I've got to meditate more here. I need maybe 30% less sleep here when I'm here, or 50% less. No, 30% less than I do when I'm out in the world teaching, traveling, and doing all kind of stuff. I'm quite pleased with that, because I get, you know, more hours per day to be able to be conscious and so forth. But when you are there, then if you give enough attention to bring your awareness back to the body, because the body is a domain that is nonverbal, that tactile field, not verbal, has nothing to say. And so it really is kind of lodging, like dropping the anchor, dropping the anchor of your awareness into the field of the body, right down to the earth element. You've got a lot of it. There you are, all sprawled all over the bed. So a lot of contact with your body and the bed. And then bringing it definitely down out of the head, down to the belly, the hips, the legs. And then now you've gone into the most boring region of conscious experience. I mean, really, there's nothing interesting happening down. And get it out of the chakra area. The chakra, of course, from the waist on up, more or less, groin on up. But get it just way down into a real boring area, just grounded and so forth. And then that whole sense of releasing with every out-breath, whatever comes up, just releasing, releasing, releasing. It's a way to get to sleep.
So what you're describing is the effect of an overall subtle attitude throughout the day or throughout the practice, not necessarily specifically in the evening.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. It is 6 o'clock. Finally, we can go to dinner on time. So enjoy your evening. See you a little bit later.